Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Welcome to another edition of Life Behind Bars. I'm the Daily Beast, half full editor Noah Rothbaum. Joining me, as always, is my colleague David Weindrich.
Hello.
Welcome. We're chatting about something. It's, I don't want to call it fake news, but it's sort of close to fake news, right?
You know, yeah.
In 2017, there was a lot of discussion about fake news and people being misled and believing the wrong thing. And cocktails and spirits were certainly not immune in our world.
Oh, no.
From all types of myths and lore and legend that often get confused.
As a matter of fact, when it comes to zombie myths that
right.
go stalking across the land, even after they've been slain a million times,
right.
there's the world of spirits and cocktails is second to none.
Absolutely. It seems, I mean, I think it's a daily fight for us to knock back some of these fake stories that just keep cropping up and up over and over again. And no matter how many times we seem to set the record straight, it, you know, invariably somebody calls to ask, hey, like, is this true?
You know, I mean, for instance, the story that Winston Churchill's mother invented the Manhattan at the Manhattan Club in 1876, which is so absolutely not true that, you know.
Right.
I mean, not only did they have no women members, but she was over in England giving birth to young Winston.
Yeah.
So it's been debunked a million times.
I mean, I think the Manhattan, I mean, we did a whole episode about the history of the Manhattan. And really, most of the episode is debunking most of the stories that people have been telling us over the last 30 years about the history of the Manhattan. You know, and the Manhattan's not alone. I mean, the Martini, too, obviously.
Oh, there's so many.
That episode, you know, it's a lot of. You see over and over again in books or TV or in articles about the connection to the Martinez and this and that. And
there's it's really, like invented by Jerry Thomas. It wasn't.
Right.
It's invented by Martini di Arma di Taggia, an Italian bartender at the Hotel Knickerbocker in New York in 1910. The Martini goes back, you know, 30 years before that. So it's there's so many things like that.
I mean, I think with some of these drinks, the truth is probably duller than the legends that have cropped up to
I mean, here's the basic problem is nobody wrote down when these drinks were invented at the time, right?
Sure.
So people start speculating, and that speculation immediately gets written down, eventually gets written down and starts circulating. And suddenly what was just, I don't know, maybe it happened this way becomes, that's how it happened.
Right.
And you've got to undo this, but you don't have any evidence to undo it with often.
And a lot of it, I think, with some of these drinks is that, I mean, they weren't extremely unique. I don't know how else to put it politely. It wasn't rocket science, right? So you look at something like the Manhattan, where it's sweet vermouth, whiskey, bitters. So, I mean, the idea that one person, like, came up with this idea, I mean, it's a little hard to believe when, you know, all these ingredients were popular, different types of combinations of those ingredients already existed. So, you know, that one person had this, you know, light bulb went off and was like, I got it. Like woke up in the middle of the night and started screaming like, I have a new drink. It's called Manhattan. You know, I mean, to be honest, it's probably multiple people. You know, coming
well, yeah,
up with,
vermouth was new in America in the late 1870s. Italy had just become unified, and suddenly there was Italy was having a business renaissance, and some smart people started exporting this this product that they thought might have a market. You know, it was a light, you know, kind of digestive wine with herbal elements, and they said, well, in America they drink some things like that. Let's send it over. And guess what? Americans said, yeah. And it's an easy thing to splash some of that into a cocktail and say, okay, you know, this tastes good.
Right.
And you could splash it into a gin cocktail, a brandy cocktail, a whiskey cocktail. You see all of those at the same time.
With a lot of the most famous cocktails, we see a very similar kind of story arc, right?
Yeah. Where
there are all these amazing legends that are often tied to a celebrity or a famous person, you know, whether it's the Bloody Mary and George Jessel. And, you know, like you have, I mean, and you want to believe them. And obviously, one of the true joys of drinking is making chit chat and, like, you know, sharing stories in a bar. And, you know, whether or not they're true, they're entertaining. And I think sometimes those entertaining bar stories, or as the Irish would call crack, crack has been written down and suddenly finds its way into history books where, you know, it's just one of these fun kind of stories to be repeated, you know.
Right. And it is colorful and it is amusing. But on the other hand, sometimes the real story is also very amusing.
Sure.
And, you know, is really interesting.
Right.
Like the cocktail itself, right? The name cocktail, there's so many myths about where it came from,
and
right?
And not just, you know, myths, but like people writing like it is fact. Like,
yeah. This is, oh, absolutely.
This is how it was, you know.
And, you know, it was because it was a feather taken from a rooster and used to stir this drink plucked from the rooster's butt. I mean, there's all this stuff like that.
Or, you know, mixing glasses that look like egg shapes that, like, you know, they showed supposedly.
Exactly. Or there's the one that the colors in the cocktail as it was being poured back and forth between glasses in this drink looked like the rainbow colors of a rooster's tail.
Wow,
you know,
I haven't heard that.
Yeah,
one.
There's so many like that.
Even just the whole idea connecting the rooster
right. To
a cocktail.
Right.
Like, I don't know when that starts, but that connection, you see rooster imagery on all types of barware, cocktail books. I don't know who.
In fact, I mean, you go back and you got to go to England and you look into the annals of the sporting life, and it turns out that cocktail was a slang term for something to make you cock your tail up. It was used in selling horses, and a cocktail was technically a piece of ginger or hot pepper that you stuck up a horse's butt when you were trying to sell it to make it look young and lively.
Wow.
And okay, that's actually really funny.
Right.
To me, that's like a way better story. You know, it's like, oh, I can see. Yeah, it makes me cock my tail up in the morning.
That's one where it's like the, you know, truth is stranger than fiction.
Exactly. Yeah.
And people are like, that couldn't be real. Like,
yeah. But in fact, that's the only one that there's any evidence for, you know, and there's strong evidence for that one to be.
And that is somehow kind of.
Yeah. Then it became like, you know, slang,
right.
Like eye opener, like
right.
We use now.
Sure.
Whatever you drank first thing in the morning.
Right.
So a cocktail became your morning drink, and it got applied to spirits and bitters, which was the morning drink.
Interesting. And the sporting life, obviously, those people who were racing and buying horses were the ones.
They were the ones hanging out in bars
all the time.
Right,
and they were the one, the first adopters of the of the cocktail.
Those probably. People didn't have offices, put it that way. Where did they do business?
The track.
At the track.
The bar.
At the bar,
right.
Yeah. But people want a story, you know,
right.
They want a story with every drink.
Sure.
It's they want the old fashioned to have been invented by the salesman for Green River whiskey or for Old Pepper whiskey, who, you know, brought it into the Waldorf Astoria bar, no matter the fact that actually the old fashioned is mentioned in print 10 years before the Waldorf Astoria opened and years before the Pendennis Club opened, you know.
I mean, again, I think it's one of these things where. Also, a lot of the brands, you know, in the 50s, 60s, 70s, even, you know, they use cocktail legend lore, you know, to help sell their products, you know, in advertising. And
same thing they're doing today, maybe a little less sophisticated, but same thing they're doing today.
But in some ways, I think maybe in the 50s and 60s, people kind of, maybe they knew it wasn't true, you know, like it, you know.
Yeah, they didn't care, really.
They didn't care, or they just thought it was funny. Or,
yeah.
As we look back at these and write articles with.
Oh, you've got jerks like me looking into the history of it all and going, that's not true. That's not true.
Or
you're making that up.
Or worse, where one of us is like, oh, I found this ad from 1949 that alleges. Like this is the history of the, you know, maybe people reading that ad at the time knew that that was a joke. We lose all context and we take it as fact.
Yeah, these people really believed all this stuff.
Right,
or this is true. It's from the archives.
Right, exactly.
You know, it's not really from the archives.
This was printed in this know, Newsweek or Time, like whatever.
Yeah. The problem is myths are easy enough to put together.
Right.
And they fall into this category of things people want to believe.
Right.
And to disprove them is very difficult because you rarely have positive evidence about where a cocktail was created. All you can do is look at the myth and chase down all the facts in it and say that's not actually true or there's no evidence for that, whatever. Well, if there's no evidence for that, some people will say, well, it could be true.
Right.
And yes, it could be. Is it likely to be true? No.
And some of these things went viral before virality
was
even discussed. I mean, these things were, you know, spread like wildfire.
Oh, I mean, one of my favorites is the myth that American whiskey went into charred barrels because they didn't have barrels on the frontier. So they took barrels that fish was shipped in and burned out the inside to get rid of the fish flavor and then put the whiskey into that. That's just bullshit. Complete and total. If you look at scientific journals from the 1790s to about the 1820s, one of the things that was being hotly debated at the time was the use of charred barrels to preserve seawater and spirits.
Right.
Many people said this has great advantages. Some guy in Western Pennsylvania pointed out that if you put whiskey into a charred barrel, it turns color much faster than into an uncharred barrel, and it looks older.
Right.
And what are these people trying to do?
Right.
Sell old whiskey.
Right. And some of them, I mean, weren't they already putting in things like charcoal or creosote into the barrel? So it's not a big jump.
It's not a big jump.
Ooh, like I'm already changing the color by adding charcoal.
They were rectifying it with charcoal.
Right.
And
you know, changing the color or the
flavor. They were trying to get some of the.
So it's not, I mean, it's not a huge jump to be like, oh, if we're already adding this, why couldn't we just turn part of the wood into charcoal?
And these guys weren't like dumb good old boys. Right. You know, they were reading scientific journals from England. I'm going to try this new technique. And guess what? It worked. And also fish barrels. You couldn't put whiskey in a fish barrel. It would leak. Those weren't the same kind of barrels. These were thin, like nail kegs, you know. Right. They weren't like watertight barrels.
I mean, it's kind of the perfect storm, though, for a myth or a legend to start, right? Because most people now in 2018, our knowledge of different types of barrels non-existent, right? Like, you know.
Aluminum beer kegs.
Right. Exactly. Sure, great. I mean, if you found a Cooper, you know, a 150-year-old Cooper, if one was still alive, and you said to them, like, could you put whiskey in a fish? He'd probably fall over laughing.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, like, but that kind of knowledge to us, we're like, oh, sounds great. Yeah, totally. Yeah. Fish barrel, sure.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
I mean, also, like, why would they use it for fish? You know what I mean? Like, if they already had a fish barrel and they're preserving fish in a lot of these places, wouldn't they need the barrel for fish?
Right.
Like, I don't.
Right. Yeah. These stories are all like that, though. The more you start poking at them, then you go, wait a minute. You know, there's something not right here.
You know, we've talked a little bit about sort of the roots of, you know, American whiskey, but. You know, I like to call it sort of the Uncle Jesse, you know, from the Dukes of Hazzard,
theory
of American whiskey, where, you know, and certainly the bourbon companies have only fanned the flames of this myth that it was sort of this idea that it was all these good old boys in the backcountry of Appalachia, you know, who were responsible for American whiskey. And to be honest, it's not. I mean, you know, at the turn of the century before, a lot of the people. American whiskey industry were Jewish people who had come from Eastern European countries.
Yeah, and you go back, that's absolutely true. I mean,
who brought this knowledge where they had been making alcohol because they needed kosher alcohol. So they, you know, and a lot of these countries for various, you know, reasons, usually somehow involving anti-Semitism, were required to collect taxes or make the booze or both and, you know, run the pubs and, you know, the pubs were kind of the stores or the hotels, especially in Poland or Russia. And, you know, they come to America and it's one of these things like any other immigrant economy, you know, one person comes, you know, they have the skill set. They start working, making whiskey. They bring all of their Lonsdale.
You get the Rosenstiel family, Shenley, you know,
they've all this knowledge and suddenly, you know, it becomes so, you know, making alcohol in America becomes so synonymous with Jews that like really well-known anti-Semites like, you know, Henry Ford.
Right.
Like one of the reasons why he's backing prohibition is because the way to sort of undercut, you know, the so-called power of Jews in America.
Exactly.
Because he's taking away, you know, one of their main industries. And
Yeah, the distilling industry was considered really disreputable, right. You know.
So, you know, after Prohibition and, you know, both World Wars, and we finally get the American, you know, whiskey industry up and running, and Jews still heavily involved.
I mean, oh, yeah.
Jim Beam is owned by a Jewish family. You know, Rosensteel, you know, Louis Rosensteel, you know, who's and the Bronfmans, who own Seagram, own, you know, the largest and second largest spirits company in the world. I mean, they're always jockeying for world domination.
Right. Huge names. I mean, they had so many brands. Right. Like, you know, they had all the brands.
I would say
Old Granddad.
I mean, talk about a monopoly. I mean, really, between those two companies, I mean, it's sort of like
National Distillers. But the National Distillers got out in the 1950s.
Right.
They went into the chemical industry and you know, just completely like sold all their brands.
Right. So, exactly. And a lot of them wound up
with one of the others.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. So, I mean, it's one of these things where through, you know, the 60s, 70s, and then you have people like Heaven Hill and the Shapiras, still, you know, family owned, you know, who are proudly Jewish and the largest family owned spirits company in America.
Yeah. And they partnered with the Beam family, essentially,
right, exactly.
You know, and they've,
they've
been mutually successful and gotten along quite well.
Absolutely.
And, you know, it's,
but it's interesting because, like, after, you know, World War II, Jews sort of stepped back, right? Like, and we even saw that before, like I.W. Bernheim, who starts, you know, his brand is the biggest bourbon brand, I.W. Harper. Before Prohibition, right? He uses his first two initials, right?
Yeah.
But he takes, I mean, there are a lot of theories about who, you know, Harper was, but maybe the trainer, one of his horse trainers.
Or a name out of the city directory. Right,
very,
you know,
it's Gentile like, sounding name, you know. He doesn't put his name on the bottle at all. And after really World War II, you know, Jews, while they still might own the companies, take a step back. You know, and this kind of myth that it's this good old boy making the whiskey, you know, in the backwoods.
Well,
and that sort of dominates, you know, our culture.
It's funny. I mean, if you go back also to the beginning of American whiskey, the earliest whiskey distilling I've been able to find strong record of is not in like Pennsylvania.
Right.
It's in Massachusetts colony, and they're using a German recipe.
Right.
You know, and they're talking about, well, we've got this German recipe for making whiskey out of
rye.
Right. And also they threw in some Indian corn, some maize.
Interesting.
So it's rye and corn, and they're making this whiskey in 1648, which is insanely early for America.
Right.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Saying, well, one person writes to the other one, so how well is your little distillery doing? And the guy's saying, I wish we could distill seawater. We could sell anything we can make. You
right,
know,
right.
Everybody is buying it.
State.
Yeah, I mean, so, and then you go down into Pennsylvania, and, you know, when the kind of the focus of whiskey distilling in America kind of moves down there, the Massachusetts thing turns to be sort of a one-off. And down in Pennsylvania, and all those early distillers there, if you were sitting in their still houses, they weren't English, they weren't Scotch-Irish, they were Germans.
Right.
They were talking in German. They didn't call it whiskey, they called it Korntrom.
Right.
You know, and it was, and that's the beginnings of American whiskey.
And,
you know?
And also, I think there's that new second edition of Canadian whiskey. You know, we ran an excerpt. So what Davin de Kirkemo, you know, argues in the excerpt that we ran, it's a similar thing in Canada, that everybody thinks it's, you know, early Scottish, Irish,
right,
but it's really other immigrants who bring the real distilling knowledge later.
Yeah,
from what I remember, that it's not.
There's a lot of English guys came over, and were the Scots and the Irish and the Scots Irish super important? Yes,
sure.
They were, but they weren't the whole game. You know,
and in America, that idea that like Washington imposes taxes, right? You have where, you know, the Whiskey Rebellion, that, you know, the people move further,
right.
Which may not actually be.
No, a couple of them moved.
Sure.
You know,
But it's not the central.
Kentucky was already being fully settled by people with stills. Everybody on the frontier had a still.
Right, you had to.
Yeah, it's like, how are you going to get your grain to market?
Right.
You had to distill it. You got to turn it into something that you can get cash for.
Right.
That's easy to transport.
That's really interesting.
There's the myth that we covered this last year of, like, Old Tom gin was earlier type of gin, and then there came London Dry gin as the ultimate development. It turns out that's not actually how it worked. Every gin in England was made by the rectifier who bought spirits from distillers who only made grain alcohol, basically light whiskey, right?
Not unaged that different whiskey. Than today.
Yeah, White Dog.
Basically.
Right. And then they sold it to the rectifiers. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. They were the equivalents of ADM, these huge volume distillers. So if you were making gin, you bought barrels of this fairly neutral whiskey from them that was highly, you know, rectified, distilled like three times and made as clean as possible. And
not then similar to vodka.
This is before they had the technology to get a really clean spirit.
I was going to say, if they could make vodka, they would have. But exactly. This was as close as they could get.
It was as close as they could get. Then it goes to the gin distiller who redistills it. And the gin distiller wasn't allowed to retail. So the gin distiller redistills it with botanicals, and then they sell it to somebody at a set proof. Everybody sold at the same proof. That retailer would then sweeten it and reduce it, and that became Old Tom gin was the least sweetened.
Right.
But it all started as London Dry gin. Old Tom was London Dry gin with a little sugar and a little water.
It's like listening to somebody talk about like 80s Miami and, you know, kilos of cocaine coming from.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. Same business.
It's like
you step on it a little.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And by the time it gets to the street, it's being cut with, you know, baby laxatives and whatever, you know.
Yeah. The worst, the British did a survey, one of the British medical journals, and found, you know, some gins were up very close to legal proof and only had a little bit of sugar in them. And legal proof was the equivalent of 47% alcohol, which Beefeater and Tanqueray are still sold at, right? And then beneath that, they found it as low as, you know, like 20% alcohol and tons of sugar and water. But it all started as 47% alcohol, no sugar.
Wow.
So and so that's, you know, it's one of these myths that the people always, you know, in like bartenders will tell you, well, Old Tom gin is.
I mean, even the UK now, there's a lot of kind of mystery about gin, right?
It's
like idea that, you know, gin is this now fancy pants drink, you know, 007. It's like, it actually had pretty blue collar roots, you know, where you have, you know, Gin Lane and, you know, all these. Really, it was almost like the meth of,
I mean,
you
know, it was
at a certain point where everybody is distilling it in their backyard and drinking gallons and gallons of it. And
I mean, it's funny how it came to be an upper class drink is through the British military, where you had people from the highest aristocracy being officers for people of the lowest levels of society. The officers, almost as solidarity, started, you know, hanging out in and they could drink gin.
Right.
And it was a big raised middle finger to the bourgeoisie in the middle, who was like, gin is vulgar. They're like, we don't care.
Right.
We're all, you know.
Bonding thing.
Yeah, I'm a duke. Right. I can do what I want. I'm going to drink gin with my men.
It's a funny thing. And it's this idea now that gin is this.
Yeah, I know. Like,
drink of the queen. And the whole relationship between London Dry, Geneva, Old Tom.
Oh, yeah.
Just, I mean, you could ask 10 people. And
you get 10 different answers.
At least, more.
I know.
I don't think anybody can keep it straight.
I mean,
knows, except for you, basically.
Well, you got Geneva, which is flavored whiskey made in Holland, right? They get grain, they distill it, they put maybe a little bit of juniper, hardly any, though. Right. And it's like tastes like malt and the British see this and they can't get good grain.
No.
Because the Dutch have trading resources the British don't have. And so the British are like, well, we'll use whatever we have, so we'll make it the spirit as neutral as possible and we'll flavor it not with our good grain, but we'll flavor it with like botanicals. Right. With artificial flavor. So it's artificially flavored Geneva, it starts off as. And then, you know, so it's
like
goes its own way.
It's like a copy of a copy.
Exactly. Right? Exactly. That's all it is. You know, it's like, and it becomes its own thing during the Napoleonic Wars. because Holland has got naval blockade. There's no Geneva coming out of Holland. So suddenly British gin people give it a second look.
Speaking about Napoleon, I think one of the most interesting stories we've run in the last couple of weeks was one that Wayne Curtis wrote about the sort of Napoleonic cognac.
Oh, yeah.
So it turns out
Napoleon cognac. Yeah, that's another great myth.
Right. So, of course, it turns out that Napoleon didn't drink. He liked a cup of coffee in the morning and evening.
It was Italian.
Right. He wasn't really drinking cognac.
He was not a recreational drinker.
He did visit Courvoisier, or the the predecessor to it at one point. And as I think Wayne, writes, before Instagram, he had sort of a painter follow him around, creating all these paintings of his activities. So there's a painting of him visiting this, warehouse full of cognac casks. And that that moment sort of turns into a whole myth that goes on for, several centuries, right?
Yeah.
This idea that, he was a cognac drinker when he was exiled to Elba. He took cognac with him. I mean, there's all types of crazy myths. And, it's, again, one of these things you kind of want to believe, right? You embrace it. And now, it's to the point where the brands have sort of backed off. They sort of backed off their claims.
Yeah.
But it's kind of funny because it's turned into a whole category that's now going to be codified by, the cognac.
Yeah, it's become super VSOP.
Right. So it's become like a legitimate thing.
Yeah.
And almost, pays, homage to him. But, it's one of these great myths where, for decades, people were being, misled. They're buying, and, a lot of people were buying cognac that supposedly came from his cellar or was made for him.
Cognac is, there are so many strong, reputable producers. There's also a lot of cowboys there who will say,
very diplomatic way to put it.
Yeah, there's a market there.
And a lot of stories and a lot about what happens in cognac.
Yeah.
And that's a great myth because I didn't even realize it was a myth. I never really thought about it. I just assumed that he had drunk that cognac.
Well, so many of these myths have kind of gotten built into the framework history that spirits writers and aficionados carry around with them, and
as almost as a badge,
it's all these bits of knowledge that if you look at it systematically one by one, you can kind of dismantle them. There's the myth that rye whiskey was more popular than bourbon in at the turn of the last century, before Prohibition.
This is what we may disagree about,
but you look at sales, and in fact bourbon was more popular.
It's true. Although the sales of the bourbon, though, the one thing that I'll put out there is that some of the bourbon was bought to be blended into rye, right? Like some of it goes...
Well, it goes into blended whiskey. Right. Some of the rye went into blended whiskey too, though.
Sure.
But, I mean, you look at the figures, there's 1 year where bonded, once they put in the bottle and bond act, right? If you total up all the producers of rye, the rye comes almost up to the level of bourbon if you total up all the producers of bourbon. But the IRS put out these figures back then. Are they accessible now? Not easily. Right.
Sure.
I mean, this is it takes a lot of digging,
and
you go through tax records and you got to look through the IRS commissioner's reports for all these years. And
there's a lot of weird jockeying between bourbon and rye.
Oh, yeah.
Which leads to all types of weird speculation or myths, around the early days and who drank which one and what parts of where it was available.
I mean, early on, rye was definitely more popular. Bourbon by the end of the century had really eclipsed it. It wasn't a huge eclipse. It wasn't like rye was a minor spirit.
Right.
Bourbon had the edge. I think mostly because of the West. Bourbon was the drink of in the West.
Yeah.
Like Chicago on West, it was
absolutely
bourbon.
It was that frontier town kind of drink.
Yeah. Rye, maybe a little in San Francisco again. But
and you also maybe see the rise of the temperance movement, in some of the traditional rye producing areas earlier than on the frontiers. I mean, some of the states are adopting temperance laws well before Prohibition. Maine, a lot of other places sort of put them on the books, take them away, that also has an effect. And obviously, the cities on the East Coast, which were making a lot of the rye, more affected than probably the frontier, but
a lot of the bourbon was coming not from Kentucky. It was coming from places like Peoria, Illinois, yeah. And it was not high quality.
Another one of the myths that I would say is that if you ask people in Kentucky, where can bourbon be made? They're like, only in Kentucky. Yeah. And you're like,
well, no.
It can be made in Kentucky. Yeah. Like most
it of is made in Kentucky.
The preponderance is made in Kentucky, but it can come from anywhere in the U.S. Yeah. by law.
Yeah.
Even Hawaii.
Absolutely.
And traditionally, you had places like Cincinnati and Peoria, you know, producing
huge amounts of whiskey, huge volumes.
It was. Yeah. So, I mean, it was, I mean, it's only, I would commend Kentucky for their stubbornness to continue to produce bourbon longer than any other part of the U.S. really, and their commitment to that spirit, which basically means they outlived all of the other distillers in areas around.
Well, the other ones, most of them like ended up becoming like Archer Daniels Midland and just making pure grain alcohol.
Right. Exactly. Well,
because of prohibition, it's like there was still a market for grain alcohol. And once they switched to that, that market never went away again. So it's like, okay. But before prohibition, if you were in Peoria, point of the Ohio and the Mississippi, you're surrounded by cornfields for three states around or four states around. What are you going to make? You're going to make corn whiskey, you know, and lots of it.
The other myth that kills me is the one about tequila and the worm. Like, and I still get questions about that. Doing an interview with one of the BBC radio stations on New Year's Eve, somebody called in and asked if I'd had the worm.
Oh, please.
I said, well, first of all, it's not a worm, right?
Yeah.
It's, you know, and then
it's a grub.
Somebody, or somebody called in later to say that it was technically it's butterfly larva. You know, I'm like, okay, you know what? Like, I haven't, whatever it is, I have not had it. Yeah. And then somebody texted in to say that they had had it in the 80s, you know. And,
I had it from, it used to come in the Monte Alban Mezcal.
Right. It's like a double layered myth, right? So, it never really came in tequila.
No, it was one brand of Mezcal.
It only came in Mezcal. Yeah. So, obviously, for years, nobody had even heard of Mezcal, let alone tequila.
Well, you got it down, you know, in like Southern California and Southern Texas. I remember I was with my band in Tijuana, and we brought a couple bottles of very cheap Monte Alban, which is a blended Mezcal. And, you know, it was not like the delightful stuff we have today. It was pretty industrial, but we drank it in our tour van, and we were very happy with it.
Channeling your inner Alice Cooper.
Exactly.
In 2018, but I mean, I don't know. I mean, if you gave me $1 million to produce a bottle of tequila or mezcal with a quote unquote worm in it,
I wouldn't know where to find it.
No, I don't think you. I mean,
I don't know. I haven't seen a bottle of Monte Alban in 25 years
without having to fly to.
I mean, I'm sure it still exists
or something.
But yeah,
but it's again one of these things that people hold on to.
Yeah,
forever. I mean, it's interesting because you know we finally the millennials. This is a generation who basically never really knew bad tequila, right? I mean, they've only lived in a world of Patron and Don Julio and all this other, you know, El Tesoro and other stuff. But like, you know, people who are beyond millennials, like the worm and tequila is something that you cannot break.
Yeah, it was the Malort of its time.
Right.
It was the frat drink is like, oh, you got to take down the worm. You know, it's like, that was a long time ago.
Hardwired into our brains, that connection.
Yeah.
And
that's funny.
You know, you and I travel around the world talking about booze and, you know, I almost fell over that somebody was still asking about
it. I know.
I'm like,
I have
all this work over the last 20 years.
It comes to nothing.
Right, it's amazing how humbling.
You
realize
myth is myth. You know,
it's powerful than either one of us.
Yep, it's bulletproof.
This one about the worm. So if you're listening and you care, there is never a worm in tequila. If anybody ever asks, that is the truth. And even in mezcal, that's not a. I mean, it was a great marketing ploy.
I think they originally put it in so that you could see that it was foolproof.
Right.
Because if it's not foolproof, the thing would turn to mush.
My stomach is already turning just at the thought of it.
Well, you know, I've eaten plenty of like gusanos.
Oh, sure.
You know, sal de gusano, roasted little grubs and larvae and stuff. So, you know.
I can only imagine that they were using the highest grade of grub and larva for this, I don't know, $5 bottle.
Yeah. It was a $5 bottle of mezcal.
I can only imagine that this was.
They were definitely farm to bottle.
Well, hopefully our work is not in vain. And
we'll be doing more of this, though. I can tell you that much.
Absolutely.
We'll revisit this.
Absolutely. Maybe this will be a small subset of Life Behind Bars. Here's to the truth.
Well, drink to that.
Absolutely. Cheers.
Cheers.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.